never actually done this before, so maybe I was supposed to be more judgy about it. So again, I'm Sarah Desmer, and I'm actually the editor-at-large at San Francisco Magazine. That is not Aaron's fault. That is just, I was the deputy editor, and now I'm the editor-at-large, which gives me roaming qualities, which is very exciting. And tonight, as you know, we're here for Craft to Table with restaurant State Bird Provisions. This is State Bird Provisions. And we also have Bar Tartine over there. And these people happen to also be couples, which is perfect for Valentine's Day Eve. And we're really going to talk tonight about marriage discrepancies in the kitchen. Stuart Brioza is the chef and co-owner of State Bird Provisions. Nicole Krasinski is the pastry chef and co-owner of State Bird Provisions. And as you may or may not know, they were in Bon Appetit as the best restaurant in the United States, which was huge. I was like, wow. They have gotten more press than anyone I can think of. And then Nicholas Bala and Courtney Burns are of Bar Tartine, and Nicholas is the executive chef, and Courtney is the production manager. They also happen to cohabitate. And they are, of course, Bar Tartine is also known as one of the most amazing restaurants in the city. And something that these restaurants have in common is they are run by insane people. And that's kind of what we're here to talk about tonight. In the fall of last year, in September, for San Francisco Magazine, which I have to just plug really quickly, has turned a new leaf, and we have a new editor, John Steinberg, who's hiding out back. I see him over there. And it's an amazing new magazine. It's the same magazine, but new life has been brought to it, and I've been allowed to write a column called Famished, which is just Sarah gets to rant about whatever she wants to rant about, which is awesome, because that's all I do. Now I'm being paid to do it. And I wrote a story called Can Chefs Do It All?, which was sort of supposed to be a spin-off, Can Women Do It All?, or whatever it was called. I don't know if you remember that. It was about women working. And this article was sort of based around the premise of chefs increasingly making everything in-house. And I don't know if you've noticed. I have noticed. I've been a food writer for almost 20 years now, and plates to paprika. Chefs are making everything. Plates, paprika. And I started, it kind of came to this moment where I was being shown around a restaurant in the Mission District that's a very acclaimed restaurant, and the chef was like, yeah, you know, our own charcuterie, our own mustard, our own drying herbs here, and our own, and we're doing this, and we're doing that, and we're the whole animal program and the bones, and we're making charcoal out of the bones, and we might have a goat up here on the roof one day, and he wasn't kidding, and I was like, what? We've reached this new and point in San Francisco's restaurant community where I think that chefs, we have, personally, I think, the most amazing restaurant city in the United States. We've actually gotten that acclaim recently in, what, GQ? I don't know. We've gotten some great national press, and I think it's due to chefs being a little crazy and doing everything themselves in-house. But also, is it a sustainable practice? Can you do all this and still stay in business? Because at the end of the day, a restaurant is a business. And as much as we foodies love to glorify chefs and restaurants and put them on a pedestal, they're trying to make money, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. So having all that in my mind, I set forth to interview some different chefs, and these lovely people here are mentioned in the story because of all the restaurants in the city, they are two of the restaurants that are really dedicated to their craft and are doing so much in-house that sometimes I can't decide if they're crazy or if they're passionate, or maybe it's both. So I wanted to start with them, and from State Bird Provisions, I was going to ask Nicole to just kind of give us a little laundry list. What are you doing right now? What are you guys making in-house?
We ferment a lot.
Kimchi, fermenting is hot, by the way.
Kohlrabi, sauerkraut. We just finished our last batch of hoshigaki, which is a dried hachia persimmon. What else?
What? Plums, tomatoes, there's air drying of salt cod that's happening right now on the back patio. Things like beef jerky, let's see, other preserves, lots of preserves during the summertime, canning of tomatoes, canning of, what other certain spices that we're doing as well.
You're making spice
blends.
Yeah,
blends.
Blends that we do, of course, inside, and then you know, dehydrating of these some of these fermented products to kind of give off that sour salt, and kind of farty aroma that's kind of pleasurable sometimes.
So romantic.
What's your own?
It is Valentine's Day Eve, after all.
That is a laundry list. That is big, and I don't think this has always been the case. I mean, you guys were at Rubicon. You've been here a long time, and Nick, you are slightly newer to the scene compared to these old folks here. Would you say? I mean, Nick, what are you guys making? What are you guys making, Courtney? I know the paprika is my favorite example because one time he came over the table, was like, "Yeah, we're making our own paprika." I'm like, "I don't understand that. What do you mean?" He's like, "Yeah, we're like smoking our we get our chilies. We smoke. Do you grow them?" Realizing you do grow them. Of course you grow them. Silly me. So tell me about your paprika as an example.
We have a few farmers that we use that we've been trying to isolate the best paprika powder. We do a lot of Hungarian food. It's my ancestry, and Courtney's got some Central European stuff going on too that she really identifies with. So we're really trying to like replicate some of those flavors. And the best paprika powders are from Spain and Italy and Hungary, and so we're trying to find a way to process things here in California by growing them and drying them out that are similar quality to those powders. So we've been just getting seeds from Hungary and from some hybrids and some heirlooms that are grown in the United States, and just seeing what works best here. So we've got a garden. Scribe Winery up in Sonoma, that we're growing a bunch of stuff there. We've got a buddy in out near Davis, Winters, actually. It's growing a bunch of peppers for us, since we're trying to isolate the best peppers to use for powders. Hungarian food is like half paprika, so it's really important.
Pork.
Yeah,
so
it's really important.
That's just the growing part, then?
Dehydrators, extremely hot kitchen in the summer because all the dehydrators are in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a learning process. It might not be the ideal long-term solution to trying to process paprika, but right now we're just experimenting. So
mm-hmm.
we're doing it at the restaurant and coming up with some interesting results.
And Courtney, what inspires you guys to keep doing this kind of stuff? I mean, considering the labor costs, maybe the rational side isn't super rational, but the passion side is high, but I mean, is there a point where you're like, this isn't worth our time?
No.
Why?
I think it ultimately comes down to continually wanting to know, if we're speaking about the peppers, continually wanting to know what makes a pepper that kind of perfect paprika pepper. What pepper? Is it the soil? Is it the pepper strain that is creating the beautiful oils that you get from paprika from, let's say, Hungary or from Spain? It's something that we haven't completely been able to replicate here yet. We're more or less curious if we can. Because if we can, having something that's grown here by people that we know that are passionate about what they're doing, we know the soil that it's going in, we know the people that are, we know the people that are watering it. They're a wonderful place up at Scribe. So knowing that the peppers can be grown there is huge to us. We have a wonderful relationship with them. So finding a way to get the right pepper seeds in and reproduce a climate that can produce these really beautiful oils that we know Hungarian paprika to be like. And if we fail on that front, then we'll continue to buy Hungarian paprika. But it serves us to try and see if it's something that we can recreate here. One, it's more cost effective.
Is it really?
It really,
even after all the watering and the
it really
farm
is
hands,
for paprika it is. We can talk about the laundry list of things that may or may not be. I think we talked about this briefly. The law of diminishing returns is definitely something that we talk about a lot. But the paprika from Hungary, the really really amazing quality stuff, it's extremely expensive.
How much? I'm curious.
Oh my God, we pay maybe $300 a kilo.
So how much is used in like a dish of?
Real easily,
kilo.
Yes.
It's like caviar.
We'll easily bloom like 320 grams of paprika for a small batch of sauce.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's like a quart. Like, yeah, it's 32.
All right. You guys are going to be like paprika millionaires soon.
The funny thing is last year we planted, we were subletting a place and we had these huge bay windows. And we planted maybe 65 different varieties of peppers. We started them all just to see which ones would create what we were looking for. They got put in the ground and we have no idea what's what. But we got a ton of beautiful paprika out of it. And it was kind of an experiment to be like, what is different from the next? So yeah, it feeds a curiosity and a passion.
So having listened to them talk about this, what are you guys doing at State Bird that's, you know, that's something that you're, one thing that you're like trying to perfect that you really want to be able to do better? Because we talked a lot about, well, what's the point in doing something if you can't do it better? You know, that's what you said that.
I think that, you know, when we opened State Bird, it was really under the premise that we wanted total, like, creative flexibility and freedom. So we weren't looking for necessarily certain flavors that were going to create our restaurant. We were more or less looking it as a place where we could, I guess, somewhat have a dialogue with food and answer a lot of our curiosities, which, you know, are not only flavor combinations, but also some of these age-old techniques. Nicole had mentioned the hoshigaki, which was kind of our, you know, it's a centuries-old technique, and it's very simple, but it was so pleasurable to do.
Can you explain the massaging?
Yeah, it's the Kobe beef of
persimmons,
specifically persimmon. I mean, they're hand massaged, you know, for
you feed them beer at night.
30 days. Yeah, they're
drinking the beer.
Yeah.
You drink the beer.
Yeah. It's important to get the technique just right. You know,
The more you drink, the better the massaging goes.
Yeah, it's a long process that at the end of the day, like, we did it because the tree was sort of given to us, and we said, wow, what can we do with this? And we did a number of things.
You can only make so much persimmon pudding.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so it's coming up with some old, you know, old techniques that sort of just satisfy curiosity and you know, at the end, you know, become something that you look forward to doing the next year. And I think that that's our sort of biggest quest is, you know, going through these processes of various ferments. And I think that there's a lot of things that don't work, you know, and then you paid for it. You know, maybe a certain flavor profile that you want to put in. We did some watermelon radishes. And I put kefir lime in it. And, you know, I think the flavors were good, but I didn't care for, like, the actual flavor, but I'm looking at, you know, 2 gallons of watermelon radishes and, you know, a couple hours worth of work. And, you know, you make it work. You got to find a place for it. And so we kind of found another home for those.
You guys ate it.
Yeah. One
you
of those
like,
dishes
amazing.
That we're hawking. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, but it is. It could be something that's amazing. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, they fermented beautifully. Great sour content, but there was just some flavor to it that I didn't particularly like. But it was still like, well, cool, now I know. And, you know, without like necessarily looking, I mean, there's a couple of different ways for us. I mean, looking at the traditional aspects of it. And then also, I think most of it really comes down to curiosity. I mean, and kind of creating a sense of our own cuisine through some, you know, ingenuity that we can come up with through another culture's tradition, right?
Do you think, speaking of, that this is an American quality that you all share? Because this story that I finally wrote, as stories go, you think of something, you talk about it with someone, you're like, I want to write about that, and then 3 years goes by and you still haven't written it. And this conversation began probably even more 5 years ago with a chef named Gerald Hirogoyen, who I know, who owns Piperod, and we were sitting there, and I wish I could do a French accent, it'd be cooler. But he says, oh, you know, Sarah, you know, these chefs, they want to make everything their own charcuterie, and, you know, he's got that Basque nose, and he looks so French, and I believe everything he says about French cuisine, and I'm like, tell me, chef. He's like, you know, in France, you buy charcuterie from the charcuterie maker, and you buy bread from the bread maker, and this is what you do. What are there all these American chefs making it themselves? This is ridiculous. And I was like, you're right. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But it's also kind of amazing. And I think that's where we are right now. I think California and San Francisco is in this like moment where, yes, we've led the way before, but I think that what you guys are doing is why people are looking, I mean, why it's California-centrically and San Francisco-centrically. I think people are looking to us to see what we're doing, because I don't think it's happening in all the other cities necessarily at such a high level of intellect. But I don't think it's particular. I think it's an American thing.
Well, I think in the Bay Area, what it is that we're on this quest to sort of, which we don't really know. I mean, I don't know. I'm quest for something, and I'm not sure what that is, which I think is kind of the greatest quest of all, is that we don't really, there's not a whole lot of way to describe our food, you know. I mean, there was California cuisine, which is, you know, sort of been, you know, taken over by the entire country and embraced by the entire country and parts of the world, for sure, you know, which is just an element of freshness, right? Mm-hmm. And really simplicity and sort of the salad bowl, the Bay Area salad bowl. But I think now it's sort of like coming up with, I don't know, Nick and Courtney, and describing your own food. You can say you take this Austro-Hungarian
bend,
but then you use dashi and kombu in, you know, making goulash, or, you know, I don't know if that's true.
It is.
I can't remember that part. But, you know, and for us, it's sort of like, you know, that same idea. And so, I don't know, creating cuisine.
I think you're touching on something that I talk about a lot, which is we have a San Francisco terroir. And I don't mean like from our earth. Are we being run over? We have something that is our cuisine at this point. It has nothing to do with like what ethnic culture it comes from, but it speaks to how people prepare things and how they think about food. And I think it applies to both of your restaurants. You guys have San Francisco restaurants at the mm-hmm. core, and maybe do you feel that making things yourself allows you to have like that connection?
Yes. I heard you use the word intellect earlier, and I think it's the opposite of that. It's our approach is not intellectual or dogmatic. I have a large family in Michigan. Courtney's from Chicago. These guys have good history in the Midwest too. But like, we personally have like strong family connections, and I think that relates a lot to kind of the San Francisco, the Bay Area food movement. It's like, there's a strong connection to the land, to, you know, heritage, to appreciating things, natural things. And I think that our trying to learn to process things is just it's part of just learning and appreciating the things that we grew up with. Like, my grandfather had pickles on every meal, was like a jar of pickled jalapenos on the table, and like, that's one of my favorite flavors ever. And so we want to replicate that. Pickled herring, you know, that was something my dad always bought when I was growing up. He lived in New York when I was a kid, but like, so we make pickled herring. It's just really mm-hmm. trying to learn the things that we love and we want to recreate. It's not for attention or, you know, mm-hmm. anything else. It's just trying to connect to things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I can see Courtney.
I just think that he's talking about the foods. Like, my first like food memory as a child was like corned beef and pickles and smoked fish and all these things that very much represent the heritage that we came from, or that, you know, that I came from, and we have very similar food memories as children. And something that I think is really interesting about processing things in-house and what we do is that it's twofold. What I want to touch on here is that we create things oftentimes without knowing where they're going. They are the impetus for creativity for us. So we'll make things because we have a plethora of them. And we'll process them in a myriad of ways because we're intrigued by old world techniques and the layering of flavors. So we'll just make things, and then it's the jumping off point when we don't know what to do. So there's days where you don't know what to do with
watermelon
something.
Can I second
yeah.
that? It's oftentimes I find the creativity of a chef is based around these things that you just have
around you. Mm-hmm.
So it's like stocking your larder, your pantry, whether it's with fermented or spices or just lots of ingredients or, you know, order a dozen rabbits and I have no idea what I'm going to do with them yet. But I bought them and I'm like, all right, I'll figure it out. Like, you know, and I think that that's a really, there's a lot of it is like maybe it's just an isolated thing where you make it and it sort of goes nowhere. But oftentimes in that process comes something amazing. And that is, I think that...
Tell me about something amazing.
Something amazing.
No, but seriously, I think that... Yes. I haven't even touched on the business aspect of this, because at the end, you guys are running businesses that must remain in business. But let's go total utopia first. What is amazing?
Egg yolks. Something amazing.
Of course, egg yolks. That's what I was thinking.
We do these little financiers that use a tremendous amount of egg white. And we had a deal with, like, Pray the Ranch. I would bring them grains. They brought over, they give me all their egg whites from making mayonnaise. But we still had to produce a lot of egg whites for these financiers. So we were stuck with a lot of egg yolks, and hence the ice cream sandwich that became important on our menu, and the couple other things. And we still had more egg yolks, and so we started... timing it, and we decided to cure egg yolks because we had just so many. And so we cured them like you would a ham or anything, salt, sugar. Cure them, nestle them in. After a few days, it comes out, and you're like, wow, we've got this cured egg yolk. We hang it. Like, you know, it's a salty egg yolk, right? And it's like, where does this go?
Can we back up? How do you hang an egg yolk?
Well,
in a sack, like
it was torturous the first round. We came up with a much better system, which was not hanging it, but laying it on a little rack with cheesecloth and blowing it and drying it so it dries up to a hard cheese consistency, and we grate it. But we smoke it, and we smoke these eggs. Now you got like smoked eggs, but we started selling this as chicken botarga, which is kind of hilarious, but it kind of is what it is, right? It's a pressed egg yolk, and it became this super, like, cool thing that we were like, oh, this is great, and we, like, had 12 of them in the first round, and in one night, it was like they were gone. I was like, we need more, you know, and we started, now we've run this, like, you know, it was just a happenstance. Let's try this and see if it would work, and now it becomes this cool thing to take like a vegetarian dish or a little app or whatever it is that we grate over, and it adds this super meaty kind of texture to a dish that I've never been able to achieve in any sort of vegetable cookery. And it's kind of badass. I mean, it's, you know, and it's, you know, we've got it to a less laborious state now. But you know, we have a huge jar of these. And, you know, we kind of smoke them every day that we're going to use them. We coat them in black pepper, so they're these, like, little, like, they look like little truffles, but grate them on a microplane, and they're really cool. So I guess that would be a good example.
That's a good example.
Yeah.
You guys are going to be rich in those things, and you guys got paprika market. When you guys see the chicken botarga at Byright, you'll know.
Yeah. Or on menus everywhere.
So tell me about anything on your menu that you hire out. You know, what do you bring in that you could technically make if you really wanted to, but you don't? Because either you choose because this artisan is local and better, or because, you know, the Costco truck rolled up and it just seemed like a good idea. Not Costco, it's the... What's that?
Byright.
No, the even more supposedly evil one. What's it called? Costco. Anyhow, go ahead. Admit it. They're like nothing.
Vinegar, fish sauce.
They're like
vinegar,
we milk
fish
our own
sauce.
Milk.
We make a bunch of different vinegars. We do
and
we'll
fish
do
sauces.
Like, we make fish. Yeah.
We're
doing the pickled herring, like I was talking about. So, we can get 5 gallons of fish sauce out of a couple hundred pounds of herring for the year, but to use, you know, a year's worth of fish sauce in a Hungarian restaurant. We need more than that. So Red Boat has a great product, and we're happy to use it. You know, it's not.
We outsource
vinegar.
Katsuobushi.
Yeah.
Kombu.
Yep.
We're not yet making our own katsuobushi, but it's on the radar.
Will you explain what katsuobushi is?
It's dried, smoked, fermented skipjack tuna. It's actually the hardest food in the world. You'll see it grated in Japanese restaurants and served on top of things. And it's often the base in a lot of dashis and miso soups and base kind of clear broth bases in Japan.
Right. So if you guys don't know, Nick is Mr. Japanese guy as well. He doesn't look like it, but he actually cooked Japanese until he went to Bar Tartine. Amazing food. So he's got a whole nother side to him that you'll see flickering up at Bar Tartine, but it's not necessarily, you don't go to Bar Tartine for that great izakaya menu necessarily, but it's there. What about you guys? Is there something that you outsource, I guess is the word?
Yeah. One item in particular, and, you know, I think that certain things that you serve and, you know, little ingredients, and we use, you know, fish sauce, olive oils, things like that that we outsource. But there's generally what I think that both Nicole and I are most interested in is kind of finding a little bit more about the information, whether it's like we're there at the, you know, in Italy we use an Italian olive oil, some great California olive oils, of course, but we were like at the little Frantoio in Umbria and tasted these olives pressing, and so there is some sense of connection. You know, maybe it's just a story, and it's just sort of this, you know, kind of long romantic notion in our mind. But for an ingredient, we do a blood sausage on the menu, and it's it comes and goes. And it's a friend of ours. Actually, he used to work with us at Rubicon, who's gone on. It's a sausage recipe that we actually made together at Rubicon. And he kind of just took it, and he's like, I want to make sausage for a living. And, you know, he brought me some epic blood sausage with, you know, kind of a perfected version of what we had started with 6 or 7 years ago, which is kind of awesome. And it's kind of hard not to say no to that, you know. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, I think that that's going to be like the next major phase. What comes out of these kitchens, like when we're doing these, is this like this curiosity, and you spark that amongst all those that work with you, and you inspire that in yourself, in them, and they start coming up with these like really kind of cool and neat things, and it becomes this collaborative effort, and you know, everyone moves on and finds their own path, and all of a sudden it kind of comes back in a different way. And I think that is probably the most exciting part of what we do as chefs and restaurateurs, and this kind of quest for our own curiosity is to also see where people like really pick up, where maybe you leave off for, and see how that full circle of kind of the culinary ways and traditions happen.
Teaching young chefs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a big part.
And being retaught too. I mean, David Golovin is his name.
Blood sausage guy.
Blood sausage guy, yeah.
So something we've talked about at San Francisco Magazine is the maker culture that's going on in San Francisco. And I really think it starts in the kitchens here. This is like, I mean, if we have pillars, it's tech food. If you ask me, those are our, you know, two big conversations that always go on here. But the more restaurants that open, all of a sudden it's no longer like, oh, we make this in-house. It's like, oh, my friend, the blah, blah artisan, he did all the woodwork and so-and-so made all my plates. And my friend down the street made, you know, has the honey on their roof, and we get all our honey from here. And it's starting to be where, whether or not it's made in-house, everything is in this little, like, web of friends and connected artisans. And it's kind of intense. I mean, we actually are doing a web. I didn't actually have to do it. Or Lauren, our lovely editor who does all our fashion stuff, did it for us. But about artisans and how interconnected they are here in San Francisco. And I think it's getting more and more. So like out of the kitchen and into on the floor and on the walls and on your plates, and who hand blew the glass probably at this point, you know, there's nothing that is not touched by someone in the community. And
it's a worldwide trend right now. It's really exciting.
Well, I think San Francisco, well, again, here I go. I'm like, well, in San Francisco, we're better than everyone else.
Well,
that might not be true, but we definitely celebrate that. And I don't think that's something I think is really exciting about what's happening right now. It's out of the kitchen into the whole entire restaurant, top to bottom. So let's talk a little bit, because I'm assuming we are going on. How are we? Okay. Let's talk about the business side of a restaurant, because this is something I don't think that San Franciscans like to talk about. It ruins the whole ethos of, like, it's amazing, oh my God, it's amazing. And I've had so many restaurants, I'm like, they're amazing. Why did they go out of business? What happened? And I think as the food community, the patrons that eat and enjoy all the fruits of their labors and the, you know, God knows the paprika research that's going on, we don't think or stop to think that often about, well, we get kind of annoyed. We're like, what? They didn't make their own pasta that was hand extruded and dried and blah, blah. Like, what? They bought it from a pack from Italy? Are you kidding me? This is a ripoff. But maybe we need to calm down and just realize that it is okay to be profitable in a business and actually stay in business, that that's something you want restaurants to do at the end of the day. And I want to ask you guys about some of the less romantic parts of running a business, the labor costs and what it takes to do what you do, and is there a point where it's not financially viable as a chef and operator?
I'll just touch on it briefly, and then you can talk about it. It's interesting. I'm going to not totally answer your question, but we'll have conversations all the time where we're like, okay, labor's high. We have like a...
Will you explain what you guys aim for as far as labor costs and what's typical, and because I don't think a lot of people know that.
Budget for the restaurant?
Just what do you aim to... What's your balance? What is your goal, at least, ideally?
Percentage-wise, it's 35.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pretty close to that.
But there's two ways that there's many ways restaurants work, but you can have high labor, low food costs, or you can have high food costs, low labor.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on the restaurant. You take a classic steakhouse, you're going to have higher food costs, but you're going to have lower labor because it's just the way it breaks down. And then you take restaurants, and I'm assuming you guys are the same, where we have lower food costs and we have higher labor. It's
mm-hmm.
just the way that the processing works out as far as what we do. So we just have to kind of keep that in check, and we'll have conversations all the time. We sit at our P&L meetings. You know, this is the non-romantic side of the business. You do sit in P&L meetings, and you look at your numbers, and you say to yourself, okay, labor's high this month. We have to stop doing projects. We're going to have to stop doing projects, mm-hmm. and we're going to do this and that and the other thing. We're going to stop doing projects, and the next day it's like, is the miso working? You know, and... oh, we're almost out of pepper jack cheese. I guess we should get a pepper jack cheese going. We're almost out of salami. I guess we need to make salami. And did someone culture the yogurt? And I thought we were going to stop doing projects because, you know, we both need to be online and we need to drop labor.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it all seems to work itself out.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of have to be smart about, are you going to buy 300 pounds of cabbage this week or are you going to buy it next week?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Also, I think a good thing to realize, we're all of us are in the kitchens
mm-hmm.
constantly. In our little sort of empires at this point. And that's an important point about this mm-hmm. is we're looking at all of these things every day and checking them and tasting them and being a part of the process. And I think that helps to keep the costs down.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, at the end of the day, what's the breaking point? Where are you just like, all right, we cannot make our own Botarga?
Well, where food waste would be concerned,
mm-hmm.
to me, would be the biggest breaking point, because
mm-hmm.
it just sucks to throw anything away, period, and just be wasteful. I think it's a matter of where you want to spend your money, you know, and I think that the kitchen that we run today, and I'm sure it's very similar for you, I know it is, it's got to be, is that, you know, these are not the kitchens that we all sort of cut our teeth in,
mm-hmm.
Where they're sort of driven by the old French guard, and they were, you know, like, every little bit and piece was turned into some, I mean, yes, we have developed those habits of turning everything into something,
mm-hmm.
like everything that comes in through your door, you pay for, and, you know, to stay in business, there is a formula to make it work, you know, whether it's 30% food cost or 35% food cost with a 12% labor cost in the kitchen, or if it's a 15% and a, you know, and a 30%, you know, it's just finding the right balance. And there's certain types of cuisines that certainly produce higher kind of profit margins, you know. I don't think either of ours are, but they're in check and they're in balance. And it really just comes down to where we want to spend our dollars, you know. And Nicole and I have made a commitment to turn it into this workshop of creativity and ideas, and like if it cuts into our personal, you know, finances, I mean, to some extent, of course, we've got to live, but if it cuts into, if it cuts too much into the viability of the business, then you've got to make a change. Because you have employees, you have staff, you have a responsibility to your guests, to your, you know, to yourself. You know, this, the lineage is huge, and, you know, you're going to, I guess you're going to find ways to make it work. But again, it's like cut out this and spend money on this. I think the tablecloth thing is a great example. You know, a lot of restaurants did it to save money because costs were going up. And I look at it in a different way, that we're not spending money on tablecloths. So now, or kitchen aprons, for example, or kitchen, you know, chef coats. But I bought these, you know, I worked with a friend of mine who designed these killer aprons that they're handmade here in San Francisco. And he and I grew up together, and it's, there's a story there. And I think that that right there is worth more. How do we make that work? And it's like, well, we sell a couple aprons, and then it kind of covers, you know, a couple of aprons in the kitchen. You know, we, you know, so you just find creative ways to sort of maybe even just break even, because that's what makes you happy. And if you're happy, I think the food's going to be happy, and so will your guests will be happy. So it's kind of a simple equation at the end of it. But, you know, yeah, you got to look at your costs, too, and waste.
Mm-hmm. Just to touch on that also, we're a very vegetable-centric, for lack of a better term, restaurant. As much as there seems to be a lot of really meaty stuff being Eastern European, Central European cuisine, I would say that 80% of the stuff, would you agree with that percentage, that comes through the door is vegetable? It doesn't mean that it's not, it doesn't cost something, but it's much less cost than a lot of proteins. And it's not because we're trying to cut costs, it's just because that's what we like to eat.
I have to say both of your restaurants, vegetables, I've said this before independently about both of your restaurants. That's, to me, like, amazing, because it takes technique and understanding to make a really great vegetable dish that is not a vegetarian dish. Like, you know, that's a terrible label for things. But, yes, you're both very good with your veggies, and beautiful things come out of those kitchens when it comes to vegetables. So that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
I like meat, too.
Well, so.
I love it.
We like meat. So since it's Valentine's Day Eve and you guys are couples, and I think everyone's always interested in how it goes down behind the scenes, I want to know about, like,
you're on.
That moment where you're like, babe, we can't ferment that tonight. It's too much. I need quality time. We need date night, not ferment night. So how does that go?
We make salami till 4 in the morning. That's how that goes.
See, I tried to get them to be like, yes, there are those moments. And Courtney's like, no, actually there's not. Tell them about your basement, please. If you have basements in San Francisco.
We have a garage.
Garage, thank you.
You want to?
We spend such a little amount of time at the house that there isn't much going on in the basement. We're looking for extra storage. I mean, space is limited in the city. It's square footage is valuable, so it's difficult to have a lot of projects going. We would have a much better time if we were out in the country somewhere. You know, I remember managing restaurants in Michigan where it's like space was just unlimited. You didn't have to stand shoulder to shoulder with somebody, yeah, or, you know, bump into people all day long. But it's different here, so space is.
At a premium.
You didn't answer my question.
We keep joking that we should turn, which is not happening. We have absolutely nothing except the boxes we have yet to unpack in our home. In our garage, we keep joking that it would be a great space to put more refrigerators if it was only legal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
that we could do a lot more
anything illegal
hanging of the Mongolitsa hams and a lot more. We could do a lot of different cheese making, because different cultures act differently next to each other. If only we had more refrigeration or someone to, like, put a whole customized.
You know, it's bad if it starts to eke into your bedroom. That's when it's just like, you're like, this is enough. The relationship's over. It's all about the prosciutto.
The processing and the fermenting and the cooking is the part that we love about our job. And we could work indefinitely if that's all we had to do, but it's the other stuff that's exhausting that consumes so much of your time, because there's the administrative stuff, there's managing people, which is
exhausting.
Is exhausting. Yeah, it's I think in any industry, but we do have to pull back sometimes and be like, okay, we got to check ourselves. And it's usually like one of us is like, we're doing this tonight, and the other one's like, we got to go to bed. We have to be up at 7 tomorrow morning. But that's the stuff we love to do. So we would spend more of our time doing it if it was possible.
One of our first.
I think
first
we can parlay this into the OKCupid thing that's happening tomorrow night. I feel like it's something. I feel like I see a thread that we could just bring.
One of our
to
first
the Japanese
dates.
Sex toy part. I don't know.
I like all
something.
Of that.
All of it. It comes together. The Japanese ingredients and the date night thing tomorrow. Aaron, I'm gonna start programming this stuff.
One of our first dates ever, we pickled like 100 pounds of herring and made 300 pounds of sauerkraut.
Wow. That's how you knew you were. She is the girl for me.
We should have done a slideshow. I think the first picture I have is like Courtney standing on a bin that has it's like pressing sauerkraut.
Yeah. Brian down.
And the like angels. So you guys, do you have any? I want one fight in the kitchen, please. Just humor me or make it up. There has to be like a tense moment where you're like, oh, I just can't.
I did. I have to. There was a moment in the walk-in when we first opened the restaurant. There was. Absolutely. Where I
was, I wasn't there, was I?
You were. It was actually kind of embarrassing because another line cook was in there, and afterwards I had to apologize to him, and it never happened again.
Doesn't all the yelling happen in the walk-ins? From what I understand,
they have locks.
Generally,
you get yelled at. You get called into the walk-in. It's not good.
It's over.
Yeah.
The walk-in.
And if you're the husband and you get called in the walk-in, it's really bad.
Those are the delirious moments.
Yeah, opening
we're
restaurants.
We're much more level-headed now.
So tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing coming up and how you're expanding all your DIY. I coined that TM, do-it-all-yourself stuff. Like, how are you going to parlay that into your next project? And tell them about your next project.
Next project, okay.
It was on Eater. I read it, so... Don't recently tell me it's
or,
not true.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's we're definitely doing something. I think what it will become more of is opportunities to sort of continue like our focus and quest and just a different way of plating. But I guess I just wanted to. A big part of that next project is going to be the collaborative nature of everyone who's going to kind of help put it together. And we have a lot of that in our space now. And again, it's just that curiosity. When we opened up our restaurant, it was pretty plain and was what it was. And I knew that, but I didn't care. It was like moving into our first home or apartment with white walls, and it was like, this is ours, like, so I don't care if it doesn't have artwork on the wall yet. And everybody would say, I've got great photos to put up, and I was like, I don't want your photos, you know. I mean maybe I do if they're good, but
you're famous.
But it ended up becoming this thing where, you know, we had a kind of a friend of the restaurant who, what it was like, did this string art, you know, and we talked about that. I think I'm out, but I'll yell. And we did this, piece on this pegboard. It was kind of a blank canvas, and it was like connect the dots. Another artist who's in the room tonight with us, Leah, came in and said, oh, my God, I want that wall. And I was like, okay. And she put together this amazing... you know, idea. And that was important to both Nicole and I, is having this like workshop that wasn't set up to begin, you know, something you move into. And I want the next restaurant to sort of bear that same idea, where we've got a lot of blank canvases there. And we just live in it for a while before we really decide what we want to be. As much as I love the designed restaurant, and it's always impressive to see the design, you know, just restaurant design in general. I also love to grow with restaurants, and I think we all probably have those relationships with that. And so it goes down to that relationship, collaborative aspect of what we're doing now that I want to see continue and evolve. And then who knows where the food goes? I mean, that's just one. It's a big part of it, for sure. It's an enormous part, but it's I'm not much of a planner, so I'm more like just sort of a big picture, and the details will come when it's ready, and when they're ready to show themselves. I guess that organic nature of the Bay Area.
I think that is a great point to say that it's 5 minutes before I'm supposed to ask people to ask questions, which means you can line up. Let's see. If you have something to ask, you will want to line up at the mic right about now. Thanks, Aaron. We are looking for a single one-part question. No pitches, stories, or multiple questions, please. Don't make it all about you, okay?
I'm going to have you take this mic.
Oh, okay. All right. So, questions? The mic is there. No one's lining up yet because you're shy and you're just warming up to it, I can tell. And if you don't go up there, I'm going to have to ask them more questions, and I've run out of questions. We have one person, two. This is like The Price is Right.
Yes.
Sort of.
All
come
right.
on up.
So a question is around how much investment would you need to put something like a restaurant together? How long does it take to break even? You know, what kind of investment do you need to make personally as well as from investors?
The gory details.
Don't
I
go
guess,
into
yeah, yeah, I guess find like, an alternate
yeah,
mean.
We're going through it. So investment to open up a restaurant, it can vary. It depends on what's in the restaurant already. I mean, from, you know, I don't know. For us, you know, approximately $500,000 is what we had comfortably opened with. And of course that's working capital. You know, our projections were that we would have, you know, that paid back in 3 years, which at an expedited sort of payback, you know,
structure.
Thank you. you know, and you know, which, you know, meant we were going to be poor for 3 years, and are poor for 3 years, but happy and rich in a beautiful restaurant and great people who come in to the restaurant. Yes.
And do you see a big difference between, let's say, a casual restaurant versus, you know, something that's super personalized in terms of investments? Because there are lots of talks in terms of, I have friends who went to open a casual restaurant, requires a lot less work, but he could sleep at night in terms of finances. Do you think of it sort of similar ways? Or
I think it's all about who's running it. It really, you know, I mean, I don't know. We average, I mean, I think we have a pretty casual restaurant, for sure. But I, 100 hours a week is pretty common of work. So I don't think workload is different, but it depends on how you structure it. All these little fun, you know, DIY projects or, you know, they take time and energy. Yeah.
Good evening. Good Hi. Presentation. It's fun to see you all referring to your roots. And I get the feeling that you're all relatively young and you're all relatively trying to find yourself and who and what you are. And you're doing that with food. And I think that's very commendable. So I see a lot of success in your futures. You want to speak to that?
That's a good one.
He threw that one on Nick.
Nick, take it away.
I think my grandparents have all passed now, but I think that I still want to impress them. And so it would be... My grandfather's favorite dish was Hungarian grandfather. He worked for Ford. He was a designer. He would eat white bread with bone marrow on it. And we have that on the menu sometimes. My dad makes, he's the main inspiration for my becoming a cook, probably, because he's just got an incredible palate. But he makes, you know, one pot, one bowl soups and salads at home, and his chopped salads on the menu, half of the menu is my dad's. Actually, he doesn't know that, but just want to impress the relatives, you know. It's like, I was talking about grandpa's pickles, he called them earlier, but they're jalapenos on the table, pickled jalapenos that he grew. The goal would be to impress the relatives, definitely.
Nice.
Yeah. Awesome. I want to recreate that corned beef from my childhood. And, you know, we keep trying to do that. So, yeah, it is an honorarium to our families, for sure.
Okay, next.
First off, thank you for a really great discussion tonight. Really appreciate it. As a farmer myself, I'm just really curious what you guys find important to you in working with growers here locally. What are the most important things to you?
Where's your farm?
Just about a half mile south of Yountville here in Napa. So.
Oh, great. What's the name?
Full Table Farm.
Oh, nice. Great.
I think the most important thing for us, a lot of times, I should start by saying, a lot of times we'll be looking for something in particular, but we'll also be looking for farmers who are growing something that they are really passionate about and that is just inherently really delicious. So first and foremost, it's about being delicious. So if it fits that mark, it almost doesn't matter what it is sometimes because it has flavor, it has soul. So from there you can, if you're starting with something that has tons of flavor, it makes work so much easier. So full flavored, you know, vegetables and whatever it may be, whether it's a pork farmer or a vegetable farmer, just delicious flavors, seasonal delicious flavors and beautiful vegetables. They don't have to be the same size. We don't need all of our onions to be one size. They can be inherently different, but just something kind of unique. And something we're really looking for in the moment is Asian greens. Not a lot of people are growing them, and there's a lot of trouble with it. So
hot tip.
Yeah, hot tip.
start planting your nylon.
Planted some celtuce just the other day.
Nice. Would you agree that first and foremost it's just about being delicious?
It's about flavor. I feel like we're extremely lucky in California that we have this incredible climate, incredible area to grow things, and sometimes, like, don't want to offend anybody, definitely not you, but, like, sometimes it seems like things are grown cosmetically before for flavor, and we'll get pretty things sometimes that don't have any soul or don't have any flavor versus my mom's garden in Michigan. It's like the best of everything I've ever had, like tomatoes, peppers. It's not just sentimental. Yeah, it's like
mom grew.
Incredibly concentrated flavored things that are not necessarily always heirloom. We're always looking for the next heirloom here, and it's like sometimes I wish people would just return to the focus of, like, I don't care what it looks like as long as it tastes good. Mm-hmm. As much.
And, you know, I mean, to that, it's our responsibility as cooks to make even ugly fruit look great and ugly vegetables that are, you know, cosmetically challenged or whatever it is.
They're not mediagenic.
The ugly cauliflower. I love the story of food. I like the history of it. I mean, I love that so much, actually. As a chef, I find knowing the roots, origins, you know, why this was grown, you know, whether it's an heirloom varietal or kind of a genetically altered varietal, which isn't always it's not a GMO thing. I mean, it's like, you know, something that's adapted to a specific growing region. I mean, food's interesting. I mean, flavors of indigenous ingredients especially are interesting, whether it's like an Italian sort of Corno di Toro pepper from Puglia. You know, the best one I tasted was in Puglia, and part of that maybe was because I was standing in, like, this desert region in the sun eating this, like, you know, beautiful pepper with the local olive oil and right there, and you bring it back to San Francisco and you serve it, and it's like 60 degrees and maybe going to rain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's going to taste a little different, but, I think, you know, coupled with deliciousness is maybe the origins and histories, and I like to know why farmers grow things, too.
All right, let's go to the next question. Thanks. It's all about romance, which is why it's Valentine's Day Eve.
Yeah. I know all of you by reputation, and I think the presentation was fabulous. I do volunteer here, and I see quite a few of them. My question has to do with a TV show, Chopped. I hate to get off kind of the track here, but my questions are...
Nick and Courtney are on the next episode.
Are they really?
Or actually not. Like, I said, I mean, not.
She would own that. I'm never...
Well,
never.
I agree with what you said about the San Francisco food arena is so exciting, and it's really on the cutting edge. Yet if you watch Chopped, it's very dominated by East Coast chefs and restaurants, and it seems when California chefs, or specifically Bay Area chefs, go on, they're not indicative of the quality of food products and what you do. So if you were approached, would you be on the show? Would that be interesting to you? I mean, I just kind of would like to have your take on the show.
We've never seen it, so.
You've never seen it, really?
No, we don't own a television.
They live Little House on the Prairie. So,
I mean, it really is an interesting show, and they showcase, like I said, it's mostly East Coast chefs, and none of you have seen it? Do you know of
we've
it by reputation?
We've seen it. We've watched it. Okay. We've had discussions. I'm like looking at Olga up here about the show, and for us, for me in particular, first of all, I think it's really stressful. I think those shows are extremely stressful.
Very stressful.
Like, I question enough if, like, what I'm doing is delicious or good, or whether you like it, or am I worthy of it. I don't need someone else to, like, chop me down at the knees. My life is stressful enough. Okay. So that's really how I look at it.
Okay.
You know, it's like, I'm glad you guys come to Bar Tartine and like our food, but, you know, beyond that, it's like for someone else to be like, that piece of fish is shit, excuse me, am I allowed to say that? It's really not something I need added to, like, the third week in March. It's just not.
Okay.
There is an intrigue to be like, can I do it? Am I capable? Could I go on Iron Chef? Like, those people must be really good. That's really hard, but...
And then you have to get Doritos, shrimp, and ice cream.
It's like, what are you going to do with that?
Okay. Thank you.
We make our lives difficult enough, I think, is the answer to that.
Next. So I have a food meets technology question, which is very San Francisco. So I love Bar Tartine. It's one of my, you know, favorite restaurants in the city. So my question is, how do I hack the system and get a reservation at State Bird Provisions? Because even at midnight, 3 months out, all the tables from 6 to 9 are already gone. I don't want to eat dinner on a Tuesday at like 10 p.m. So like, how do I have your food?
Well,
you can get in line at 5 o'clock.
This is kind of embarrassing. We saw a Craigslist ad for... reservations being sold.
No way.
Yeah.
$50 a piece.
At $50 a pop for four people, which is $12.50 a person. That was really kind of silly, actually. Which they are no longer existent, by the way, so sorry. Yeah.
Our head reservationist is in the front row. Can you please raise your hand?
That's a lot of pressure you just put on
it
right there.
You just resign.
One thing, I mean, it's a small restaurant. We have about 50 seats. And... 30% of our total diners every night are walk-ins. So we allow that. We allot that. I mean, we want that. We encourage it. I think one of the great and fun things about dining at State Bird when you are there is if you're open to anything. I mean, we serve food on, like, little rails and people who kind of crowd around, like, a little pass on the kitchen. you know, creates that kind of dynamic. I mean, our intentions are that we really want you to come and eat at the restaurant. I apologize that it's so hard.
You're screwed. There's no good answer.
Yeah, it's there's not the right answer that you probably want to hear, which is there is a line that starts at a certain time. You will eat for sure. Maybe not right then and then there, but a couple of cool beer bars. And
put a Lara bar in your pocket.
In the area. Yes.
Okay. So we have for one more question. Sorry, I'm like feeling the time, the ticking clock, probably like they do on Chopped. Last question.
Yeah, so I help run Core Foods. We're a food startup based in Oakland, like 8 people. We make highly perishable packaged food, like 5 to 7 ingredients. And our mission is like get people eat more fresh, real food, no additives. So you can buy it at Whole Foods, stuff like that, but we're finding it's just like hard to reach people and really change habits having 1 out of 50,000 SKUs in a store. So we're exploring this shift to like potentially a retail model, a restaurant, something where we can touch more people. But one big question in our mind is, are we Jamie Oliver or are we Chipotle? So like, how do we create more impact? Is it we're opening a store every week that's super simple and low budget, or are we creating like a mecca and speaking, you know, with a really strong voice? And just wanted your opinion on that.
Real quickly, I'd say the first thing in that one is open one and find your footing. It takes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Open one, find people that, again, I'm going to overuse the word, that really think it's delicious, and then go from there. I don't know if it's hard to know at the beginning, like, that you're going to open the second restaurant necessarily, or what is next for Bar Tartine or all of these things. Right. So what do you guys think?
I think... Sorry, but we have 1 minute left. I didn't realize I have to ask another question. Thank you. So apparently, this is tradition. When there's 1 minute left, I'm supposed to ask you guys, Stuart, Nicole. I'm pretending I'm on top. Okay, Stuart, Nicole, Nicholas, and Courtney. What are your 60-second ideas to change the world? So I guess you each have 60 seconds, which equals 4 minutes. Go. Don't screw it up, though.
Don't overreach. Inspire your immediate presence, your immediate surroundings, whether it's a small group like this or in our restaurant. We get to do it, you know, 150 times a night with our guests. That's our reach. And with the internet, it's a totally different thing, but this is within our tangible reach, and that's what I think is next.
Yeah. Just treat people with as much respect as you want to be treated.
That was good. That was way less than 60 seconds.
I think that... Every profession has there are people can coach people, can give people advice, and then there's a psychologist. There's people that can you go to a restaurant and have a chef cook for you, or you can. A lot of people are great home cooks, and I think that it's always just it's great to have respect for. People that do things as a profession, and at the same time, really appreciate things that you can do well yourself. Like a lot of people that aren't psychologists give great advice, and a lot of home cooks, my dad, I make the best food in the world. So I think it's really good to appreciate people that, you know, chefs and restaurants for putting in that effort, but then also really appreciating like. Wholesome good things that you have a connection to, I guess.
Have a connection. That's something that came up a lot. Okay, Courtney, round it up.
Changing the world? Are we really talking about? Be passionate about something. That's like, I don't care what an individual is necessarily passionate about. I love when people are passionate about something. It can be like, maybe you're passionate about whatever it is. I don't need to make any examples. And the other thing is just, plant something. It's like we hear all these things about what's going on with the world. Plant something in the ground. see what it's like to take it from seed to soil and then eat it, and like just the process. Experience that, even if you only do it once, because it's pretty amazing.
I told these guys that I just finished reading Cooked, which is Michael Pollan's new book, not out yet, but if you're an editor, you get to read it ahead of time. And I will tell you now that he makes one point, and it's something you guys made repeatedly tonight, and he talks a lot about why people cook when there's grab and go, and like, I mean, you know, sorry, I thought that was my phone automatically. I was like, oh. And he says, basically the reason to cook and is to have a connection. And you guys talk so much about that, and I think that's really at the core of San Francisco's restaurant scene right now. It's what makes it really exciting. And having said that, thank you guys for being here. I appreciate it, as if I had anything to do with gathering you here. Thank you, Aaron. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Wait. Oh, no.